Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 9th of August 2015. My name's TRP Watson and this week I'm joined by Paul in London, Nick from Pastor's Obstructed View and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Grand Hotel, which is on at the Southwark Playhouse. This is, well, we're getting rather familiar with these two, director Tom Sutherland and producer and casting director Danielle Tarento, putting on musicals, and they get quite a lot of enthusiasm, I believe. Paul, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Yes, they are getting a bit of a name for actually something you just have to go and see. I think we saw the Grand Tour earlier this year at the Finborough, which was an equally excellent production of what is perhaps a challenging musical. Now, this one is probably not as challenging, but it's not without its difficulties. Grand Hotel is based on a 1929 novel by Vicky Baum, but it's probably better known as the 1932 Hollywood film, which seemed to be a vehicle to squeeze as many stars as possible into a single film. So the plot is not much of the plot, but it basically revolves around the events and people staying in this particularly luxury hotel in 1928 Berlin. There's a fading prima ballerina, a dying Jewish accountant, a very good-looking, handsome, but broke, a baron. There's a drug-addicted doctor, a typist dreaming of success, and a crooked businessman. And what happens in the piece is the stories of these characters, how they relate to the hotel staff and how they relate to each other, come into play. Now, this piece, you know, it seems like an excellent source of material for a musical, but it actually had a bit of a troubled history. They first attempted it in the 1950s with the book by Luther Davis and music and lyrics by George Forrest and Robert Wright, and they called it At the Grand. They moved the location of all the action to Rome because they were worried about it being too close to the war. But it flopped and it never made it to Broadway. And it wasn't until 30 years later when Tommy Tune got hold of the piece and actually reworked a lot of the story, went back to the original source material, and also hired in Maury Yeston for additional music and lyrics, that the piece actually came together and it came to Broadway in the late 1980s. And what he imagined it was a non-stop dance and musical extravaganza. So it's less important, you get the sense in this musical, about the actual characters than their relationships. And the wonderful thing about this production is how they've actually taken that whole premise about people coming, people going, and using a very ingenious and very narrow traverse stage to actually show this. And I think the first thing about this musical is that is absolutely incredible is how it sounds, whether it is actually the location of the audience because we're sitting on either side of the action or whatever they've done to the sound. I think it's one thing that's remarkable in this production is how terrific it is. You can actually hear the individual performances. You can hear the music so clearly. And I think that's also testament to the new orchestrations that this piece has been given. It's been reworked for a band of seven, which sounds a heck of a lot more than it does. And it's absolutely incredible to actually hear, you know, people singing a very complicated counterpoint while doing some very terrific fancy footwork. And I think that's a testament to Simon Lee's orchestrations, but also music director Michael Bradley in actually making it sound terrific, but also the performances themselves. I won't go into the performances so much. Maybe someone else can talk about that. But I think this piece has really taken the essence of what this musical is about and really maximized it in the smaller, intimate space of the Southwark Playhouse. And I think what is actually wonderful about it is how well it lingers on after you've seen it. Even music that, you know, I was familiar with the work from having seen the Donmar production and also listened to the cast albums. But this piece gives a fresh interpretation to the music and, you know, the music itself, you know, not every song is particularly memorable, but the way it's been presented here, I think, is truly truly magnificent and probably as close as possible as to actually presenting this work in its best possible light.
Nick, what did you think about it?
I thought this was a very strong production as well. I wasn't familiar with the musical beforehand, but I definitely can see that the idea behind it was this kind of relentless parade of song and dance coming at you, because that's very much what it feels like. And I think that's really its strength. I don't know whether it's written without an interval, but it's certainly played without an interval, and that really works, because it is, for me, I think the strength of it is just the sheer energy that you get from the cast. And it does kind of, it keeps you interested in something that sort of the individual stories, I think, as Paul said, they're not necessarily the most developed stories. You're not really getting into really deep characters, but it's so kind of non-stop that it doesn't really matter. You get really sucked into it. I think it's very well performed. I thought there was Elisaveta Grishinskaya is the ballerina, and Christine Grimandi is not an actress I was familiar with, but she's got a real sort of sad warmth to that role of someone who clearly is too old now to be doing kind of command performances as a ballerina. But I think this is kind of the theme with it, really, is that the real difference between the haves and have-nots in this is that they've got front, because she's really not the only one of the residents who doesn't have any money. In fact, I think there's only really one of the characters we meet who's got money, and that's Otto, who's played by George Ray. And as you say, he's the Jewish guy who's dying, so he's basically cashed in everything he owns just to kind of enjoy his last few weeks or months on Earth in this kind of opulent surroundings. But everybody else is kind of going on front. They're brazening it out to pretend that they've got money, and then most of them have got absolutely nothing. The Baron, who's kind of the central role and played by Scott Garnham, is, in theory, he kind of steals to make up for all his debts. But in practice, he's not very good at it, because he's got too much of a conscience towards the fact that the people he's stealing from don't have much either. So very good performances, very good. I agree, it's not one of those where you're going to come out humming the tunes instantly, but it does actually have a couple of good showstoppers, which I think sometimes with these sorts of shows where the music is more kind of storytelling, there aren't any moments that stand out, but there are two or three songs here that are real kind of big moments. I think there's a couple of little things I wasn't crazy about, particularly I really wasn't sure how much Tom Sutherland was trying. He kind of has this conceit for the ending of the kind of dissatisfied staff rising up against the guests, and I wasn't quite sure how much that was to be taken literally or how much it was because of obviously the time and place that the story set, how much he was trying to suggest that we're only a couple of years away from the Nazis starting to rise. And there's kind of an attempt at a special effect for the very ending, which they clearly just can't do. So I think that might have been best left as it was, because, without giving any spoilers, they tried to do a big kind of catastrophic ending, which doesn't quite pull off. But apart from that, I think it's very, very good. Gareth?
Yeah, I've got quite a checkered history with this show, really, because I saw the original 1992 production, which came over from Broadway, and it had run, I think, for a couple of years on Broadway, and over here it only ran, I think, for something like 4 to 6 months. And the main reason for that is they put it in the Dominion Theatre, which is probably one of London's biggest theatres, a vast, vast space, and it was just completely and utterly the wrong venue for the show, and it just didn't work. And then we did get a sort of bit of a rehabilitation with the Donmar production that Paul talked about, which was good. But I still kind of, even then, didn't, I thought the show was much of a muchness, really, this whole idea of just what is effectively a character-driven piece, and I still wasn't kind of convinced by it. So what this production does is kind of just look at it afresh for me. I walked into the theatre and saw the small space, the Travis staging, and I thought, oh my God, this is going to be the opposite problem to the Dominion. This is going to be, really cramped on this space. But as Paul said, it actually has the opposite effect. It actually gives it an incredible flow and a kind of feel of people moving around the foyers and whatever of this hotel. So I actually thought that staging, despite my initial impressions, actually worked very well. It is a very, very good production. I think it's particularly good musically. The band is, I think, one of the reasons why the sound is so good. I think there are two reasons why the sound is so good. One is because it's largely a string
orchestra, so that you don't have sort of amplified instruments as such. So, you know, you don't have guitars and synthesizers and whatever. And I think therefore the string sound is easier in this space. But they also seem to have mastered the sound problem that Southwark often get. And I was looking up and they have a lot of small speakers sitting alongside the lights pointing down at the two banks of seating on either side. And I think between the fact it was string heavy and the fact they put this new sound system in just did, again, as Paul said, did just make it sound absolutely lovely. It is very well sung. I mean, Scott Garnham, whose character, the Baron, is central to the whole piece because he's robbing people. He falls for two of the characters. He's befriends other characters. So he's, I think, a kind of pivotal character. Really. I thought Scott Garnham was great, but he was particularly in fine voice. I thought he sang that part really well. And the lady, Christine Grimandi, that Nick mentions, is in fact an Italian singer, and this is her UK debut. So that's why we've never heard of her. And I just thought it was fantastic. I just thought it was a great performance. She really inhabited that kind of, that Russian, you know, fading Russian ballerina role very well. And her assistant, Valerie Kutko, who we do see quite a lot on the fringe here in places like the Landor, who's her companion stroke assistant, and there's a hint of perhaps a little more. She actually was the original, or took over the same role. I think it's Raffaella. She took over the same role in the original Broadway production in 1990, which I thought was a rather nice kind of rounded thing. And then we've got this kind of narrator, this doctor who's a sort of drug addict doctor who acts as a kind of narrator. And that was the role that had to be taken over at short notice because the actor had some family problems. And David Delve took over that role, and I think has really kind of made it as though you'd never know he'd taken over. I thought it was a very confident kind of performance. So I enjoyed it very much. I thought everything about it. You know, Lee Proud, who's a choreographer we've seen quite a lot of, you know, how he manages to create that kind of very fresh, sparkling choreography in such a small space is a bit miraculous, really. And even though there's not no set as such, because you've just got a floor and a chandelier, I thought the costumes were particularly good as well. For me, it just kind of was a revelation for a show I've never really taken to, really. And I think it's, you know, yet another feather in the Sutherland Tarento cap. I'd just like to mention just another thing, really, is Danielle Tarento does do her own casting, and she often sort of finds new people in drama schools and gives them their first outing. And she's done it for three people here. There are three 2015 graduates here: Jami Kasongo, Jerome Stokes, and Leah West, all of whom I think are really good. And I think it's great that, you know, not only is she using established casting, but she's introducing new casting to us as well. So a great night. My only dilemma now is, have I got time to see it one more time before it closes?
Actually, I hadn't checked the band, but actually I think that is right. The strings actually, you know, really helped. But I also looked in the top and noticed all the little speakers as well. So I thought, I wonder if that's helping.
We're now going to talk about Heresy of Love, which is on at Shakespeare's Globe. This is Helen Edmondson's 2012 play about the life of Suor Juana Inés de la Cruz, who was the writer of plays such as The House of Desires and was also a poet and writer of some importance, despite the fact that she was a nun living in Mexico in the late 1600s. It was originally done at the RSC, where Juana was played by Catherine McCormack. In this, she's played by Naomi Frederick. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
It's set in what would now be Mexico, but I think at the time it was called New Spain. So we're back in the 17th century. And the Spanish colonists rule through a viceroy. They have a viceroy in Mexico City. But the Catholic Church is very powerful, and they wield a lot of power in the land through their resident archbishop. And the convents there at the time, based on this play, were rather more liberal than you might expect. So the nuns were able to write secular works, and indeed they employed servants, some of them, amongst other things. And there's a kind of very delicate power balance between Madrid, between the viceroy and the archbishop, and indeed the indigenous people. And the important thing for the play is that a new, rather more zealous archbishop actually turns up from Madrid, and he kind of disrupts that balance. He questions, you know, whether these people, these nuns, really should be writing plays and poetry. And somewhat ironically, she's written a play in honour of his arrival that he doesn't even go and see. And he also questions the fact that she's very close to the viceroy and to the court in Mexico. And those things have been kind of tolerated or indeed even encouraged by his predecessors, who's kind of have gone native in a way. And that balance has been there now for many years, and he comes and disrupts that balance. And then we get a series of events like book burning, and then she herself is then sort of targeted. So the main focus of the play is the kind of the change in the church's attitude to Sister Juana, and it unfolds in that way. She has a confessor who ends up doing the archbishop's business, Father Antonio. And there's a rather more Machiavellian bishop, Santa Cruz, who is a bit bitter because he feels he should have been promoted to archbishop, and he plays a much more duplicitous role. And then we have a subplot that involves Sister Juana's niece, Angelica, and a relationship with another member of the court. I actually thought it was a very, very well-written play. And it seemed to me to be anchored in some good research of the real life. But obviously, you know, that's been extrapolated to create this piece here. It was surprisingly light, really. You know, you might, you know, listening to all of that, you might think, oh, gosh, this is all a bit earnest. But actually, it was surprisingly light and often funny, but not really disrespecting the sort of subject matter. They turned the Globe stage into a convent just with some kind of wrought iron and books, really. I thought it was quite clever the way Michael Taylor had created his 17th century Mexican convent. And of course, they use music, as is often the case here. And there's a trio of musicians. The music's original music by William Lyons, but it's kind of very period evocative kind of feel for it, really. I'd seen The House of Desires because back about 10 or 11 years ago, the RSC had this Spanish Golden Age season, and The House of Desires was one of the plays, I think five plays, in that Spanish Golden Age season, even though she wasn't Spanish and she was a bit later than the Golden Age. So I was really quite interested in the character because I'd seen a play by her before. So I you know, that was one of the things that drew me to come and see this. And I thought it was a very, very good piece of work. And again, along with things like Blue Stockings, it was one of the best things, I think, that the Globe have attempted in terms of new plays on their stage. I think Naomi Frederick is really good. I think she really, really, really is good as Sister Juana. And of course, the last thing we saw in was Maiden Dagenham, so that was quite a contrast, really. Well, the last thing I saw in, anyway. I think the bishop, who is the Machiavellian one, is played by Anthony Howell, who I thought was excellent. And he also has, it's interesting, Rob, because he has soliloquies direct to the audience where he kind of tells us what he's really up to, as it were. And there's a lovely pairing of Sophia Nomvete or Nomvet and Gwyneth Keyworth, who are the maid and the niece of the sister, and they bring a really particularly nice kind of complimentary light touch to the whole thing. And the Archbishop is played with great presence, I think, by Phil Whitchurch, who we don't see enough of. So I thought, you know, it's only 3 years since the RSC did it, but it's a new production, and I actually thought it was both a very good play and a very good production. And I've been recommending it to lots of people since I saw it on Sunday. So good for me. Nick?
Yeah, I have very little to disagree with there. I thought it was very interesting. It's also nice to see that a theatre like The Globe, which kind of, I mean, it's been a real story of the last couple of years, that, you know, sort of roles for women. And I mean, the Globe is a theatre that in theory has more disadvantages in trying to kind of even up the score, but it shows that even the theatre like that, that's as classical as that, can come up with stuff like this. And of course, later this season, we've got Jessica Swell coming back again with Nell Gwynn, which will also be kind of a very female centred one. So it's very interesting to see a Globe of all places kind of really showing that it isn't hard to come up with really good stuff that has a lot of good roles for women. And I also really noticed the set design. I think it's, again, it's something that kind of, there's a bit of received wisdom that you can't do very much with the Globe stage because it's such a particular design. But this design that kind of covers up most of the balconies at the back and has, as you say, these sort of wrought iron gates in the middle that kind of move around and create lots of different kind of locations. So it does really show that it's a bit more of a flexible space than people give it credit for. And you can really impose a personality. Onto a set design there. So I think it's a really interesting play. I think what's most impressive is that there's kind of sections of just quite simply theological argument on there, and it's presented both in the writing and the production in a way that isn't boring. I think that's the sort of thing that can make me tune out, and it really didn't in this. Yeah, just very good productions. Again, I do really like Naomi Frederick, who I think I first saw at the Globe when she played Rosalind a few years back. And yeah, Sophia Nunvett is another real standout. Again, she's really kind of, her character really helps bring kind of an earthiness and kind of down to earth side to a story that is kind of dominated by theological argument and belief in that way, in a kind of intangible way, and it's good to kind of have these characters in the middle of it, which really bring it back down to earth. And it is really ultimately, I think, a play about the very human side of these people is what proves their downfall. So I would say it's definitely well worth seeing. It's I mean, as with all non-Shakespeares at the Globe, it's got a fairly short run, but it's worth catching while it is on.
I think it's doing very good business. It seems to be selling very well, which is great to see, even though it is, as you say, only a short 3-week run. And the night I went, which was, I think, Monday, when I know Tim was there as well, it was a very particularly young audience and very much a female audience, and they were clearly kind of captivated by this story.
There was certainly, I went a couple of nights after that. I think I did up on press night, which wasn't packed, but it was quite full for a non-Shakespeare. And I agree that, I mean, there was kind of spontaneous kind of applause and cheering sometimes from the women in the crowd at kind of seeing, you know, a character from that many centuries ago kind of, you know, pushing kind of quite a defending women's rights to think, even.
Yeah.
I agree with most of what people have said. The only thing I would add is I did get reminded of something I thought some years ago, that if anybody has made me dislike Catholics, it hasn't been my family, it has actually been the theatre. And I felt there was quite a lot of distaste for Catholicism in this play. I mean, although it, you know, it's entirely set against that, and it's not presenting really another view. But what I did find interesting is the way that Helen Emberson balances that to a certain extent in one of the debates that they have when the Archbishop finally meets Sister Juana. He puts across the very real danger of what you will end up with if you don't submit to the church. You know, you'll end up with a sort of all the chaos of freedom. He kind of has a point, but people do tend to prefer, you know, freedom of ideas. And it also reminds you that we have come somewhere. We haven't got there, but we have come somewhere with women's rights to a certain extent, that we can look at this and say that it was unacceptable that when you have a smart woman, that she can't just be a smart woman out there in the world. She had to be cloistered away because there was nothing the world could do for her. And we have come somewhere, but we haven't got there yet, I think.
I didn't feel it was against the Catholic Church. I felt it was against the hierarchy of the church, because at the beginning of the play, the Catholic Church and the nuns and the local people and the court are all very happy with each other. And it's only when the sort of the big guy comes down from Europe and starts sort of, you know, his inquisitorial stuff that things go out of balance. So I felt it was more sort of anti the authoritarian elements of the Catholic Church rather than the church itself. That was my take on it.
I would agree. I think it is a very particular kind of element of the church that it's kind of going against. And, you know, I think it is relevant that, although also you've got the confessor who kind of will go with every way, you know, whichever way the wind blows, that's what he agrees with. But, you know, essentially you've got one person coming in and putting across this attitude. It just happens that he's the one with all the power. And yeah, and I think it is. It's certainly, I think that, I mean, there's enough characters in there who are, you know, Catholics and, you know, nuns and priests who have a very genuine belief and are presented very positively. So yeah, I would agree it's more about certain attitudes than it is about the church in general. And I mean, it is pointed out that a lot of this issue is personal to the Archbishop. I mean, it's, there is this whole thing where he literally can't look at a woman. So, you know, it is, there is kind of a misogynistic side to him, which he kind of finds ways to let the church justify that rather than that being what we see of the church.
We're now going to talk about a number which is on at the Young Vic in the Maria space. It stars John Shrapnel and Lex Shrapnel, his son. It has been done like this quite a lot. Now, A Number is Carol Churchill's play about cloning. It's from 2002 when it was first produced by the Royal Court and starred Michael Gambon and Daniel Craig. Whatever happened to them? And later was done in 2006 by Timothy West and Samuel West. They put the production on, I think, at Sheffield, and then it went to the Menya Chocolate Factory. The idea of this play is that we are in the near future, human cloning is possible, and a character discovers that he is one of a set of clones. He confronts his father with this idea, and his father says that he was cloned from his dead son, and that after that a whole number of clones, unofficial clones, unauthorised clones, have been made, which the father doesn't know anything about. He knew about his son being a clone of his older, other dead son. They normally refer to them as Bernard 1 and Bernard 2. So this living son, this cloned son, is Bernard 2. Unfortunately, the father, we discover, is lying about Bernard 1. Bernard 1 didn't die. He was... It's not entirely... I don't get a feeling that he's entirely clear in the play, but he just... Bernard 1 is just sort of unstable and was sent away in some way. The father was living the kind of lifestyle that wouldn't allow him to look after the son properly, and he therefore had Bernard 1 cloned into Bernard 2 and at a slightly later date, and brought him up better and brought him up to be the kind of son he wanted rather than this disappointment. So obviously you get a friction between these two characters within the play. He then, right at the, towards the end of the play, I won't say what exactly happens in this, but towards the end of the play we meet one of the unofficial clones, and the father tries to get used to him because the other two for some reason are out of the picture, and he tries to get to know him, tries to understand who he is and how his genetics may have affected the way that this clone, this completely different person, you know, somebody who he's had nothing to do with nurturing, he might have affected his life, though, how his nature, the genetic nature, might have affected this clone's life in some ways. This is staged rather cleverly at the Young Vic, well, I thought rather cleverly. It's directed by Michael Longhurst and has a design by Tom Scutt, which is an enclosed room with mirrors all the way around. So you could obviously put some symbology in there and say, or symbolism in there and say, this is the clones being images after images going off into infinity, so you can make an infinite number of exactly the same people, and that's how you see all these reflections sort of going off into infinity. But I just did like this idea of them, you know, sort of sitting in this mirrored room. It somehow made the play much more affecting, and I was much more attentive to it than I've been. I've seen the sort of three major the two of the major productions that I've mentioned. I saw those, and I didn't really get it quite as well as I got to this particular version. Somehow it was clearer and crisper, and whether that was to do with the direction and the design, they're sort of standing up, pacing around each other in their arguments, the two actors. So I thought it worked particularly well, and I was rather impressed. You know, there were other things I wasn't impressed about the production, but that's largely because they haven't got the idea of seat wrangling and the seats are all too close together and that sort of thing. What did you think about this, Nick?
It's a play I like, although I didn't see the original production. But this is still my third time, because there was also a TV version which had Tom Wilkinson and Reese Ifans. And I also saw the one with the Wests, Tim and Sam, not Fred and Rosemary. That really would have been high concept. And I really liked this production. I just wonder whether, because I've kind of seen the story three times in the last decade, whether I think some of the effectiveness of it comes from not knowing what's going on. and having the story kind of unfold in front of you. So I think that's one thing that I didn't enjoy as much this time, is that I was a bit too familiar with the story going in, and it does rely quite a lot on that element of surprise. It is very well performed. I think always with this one, the son gets kind of the meatier role, because he's got to play three characters, and it's not kind of a straightforward piece of doubling, because you've got to play these three people who are genetically identical, but in every other respect completely different to each other. And I think Lex Shrapnel does a very good job of differentiating between the three different versions of the same person, of the same genetic person, and without kind of overdoing it, without it seeming like a sort of acting exercise, it comes across very naturally. But I also think that possibly of the versions I've seen, I think John Shrapnel is one of the most interesting looks at the older character, at the father. Because I think there's a real kind of magnetic sort of sociopathy to him. I think you kind of really appreciate how much he never kind of learns the lesson that is, in a way, the belief that he had that started this, that you can replace a human being quite easily. And I think that the ending of the play really proves that he hasn't learned that lesson, that he does still think you can replace people. And it is kind of quite a fascinating character. And I think you really appreciate that in John Shrapnel's performance, in a way that maybe I haven't kind of picked up on as much before, because the son is the showier role. I do wonder whether it's kind of because of the structure of the story being kind of based around revealing the truth, starting with a bit of a mystery as to what's going on and gradually unfolding that. I do wonder whether how many consecutive times you can watch it and get the same effect from it. But it is one of my favourite Carol Churchill plays, and I think it is very strong and very very interestingly designed and produced.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azzetta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.